these years I've been in Alaska, they've been talking about this gas line. We're still talking about it, but now the show has begun. One gas pipeline project is an open season now. Another will be soon. What does this all mean? Maybe we'll find out a bit today. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The number statewide and toll-free is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@APRN.org. Larry Pursley, Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, our guests on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
So, yes, there is a person who's in charge of coordinating Alaska natural gas transportation projects, but except we don't have one. But maybe we will. And if we do, and even if we don't, we have a person in charge of it, and that's Larry Pursley, former journalist, legislative aide, gubernatorial aide, publisher, and now coordinator. How's it feel to be a coordinator, Larry?
Well, I never thought as I'm pushing 60 that I'd be a coordinator in life.
Well, here you are in Washington, D.C. This is the job formerly occupied by Drew Pierce. One would have to say it took a while to displace her and put you in her place. And that was done by the Obama administration. And so now you are in that place. And I understand it's a pretty big office there.
We have a substantial office space in Washington, D.C. We also have a smaller office space in Alaska and Anchorage in Midtown.
And is it your job essentially to like stay up to date, answer questions, and do what you can to hustle this project along should there be a project?
Sort of. That's a good description at this point. Ultimately, our job, as established by Congress in 2004, is if there's a project, and if the project sponsor would then apply for permits from federal agencies, it's our job to make sure that that permitting process moves smoothly, that no federal agency imposes a condition on a permit above what is required by law that would hinder, slow down, delay, hamper the project. So we're supposed to oversee that permitting process. But you're right. Right now, there's no permit applications. No one has decided actually to go build it. So our job is to work with the federal agencies to help them prepare so that everyone is ready should that day come, so that everybody's working off the same maps, has the same information, so the applicants, the agencies understand clearly what is required of them and they're ready. So it's prep work, hoping that there'll be something at the other end.
Well, it would be a colossal public works project. There's no doubt about it. I mean, if we're talking about a gas line that goes into Canada, links up with the existing pipeline network, we're talking about multi-tens of billions of dollars.
Right. You are 30 to 40 billion, largest private construction project ever.
And so it's only natural that, nobody's ever had to do this before, quite. But, I mean, there's been a lot of pipelines done.
Sure, smaller pipelines. Right. There's tens of thousands of miles of natural gas pipeline across North America. Companies have been building natural gas interstate pipes for years. But as you say, this is the largest. This is the most expensive. This is the most complex project, logistics, moving material, getting built, dealing with permits in two countries. So, naturally, the project sponsors, the everyone involved, you just start getting nervous about delays, cost overruns. So the more you can do at the beginning to minimize the risk of cost overruns, delays is good. But so we're hopeful.
Well, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission came up here in pretty large force and explained and to all interested parties, here's the process we're going to use. And now we seem to have this process underway. We have TransCanada now in open season. And we don't really know from the outside until something gets filed. It's kind of this black box.
It is. I liken it to that when we were younger and the astronauts would go to the moon, and when they hit the backside of the moon, there's no radio contact till they come back out. And they call in and say, we're heading home and all is well. Same thing, the open season is where the two projects, one being TransCanada Exxon, the other being the Denali, which is BP and Conoco, they go out there and say, here's what we think we're going to build. Here's what we propose to build. Here's how much we think it's going to cost. Who wants to use our pipeline? And then those bids that they come in to the two project developers are not public. They get turned in. They start negotiations with the potential shippers. And hopefully, if they reach what's called a precedent agreement, which is sort of the first step, that gets filed with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and then it can become public. But until then, you're hoping there are bids. You're hoping negotiations are going well. Maybe we'll hear something on TransCanada by the end of the year. Denali is hoping by early next year they would have signed precedent agreements they could file with FERC and proceed on to the next step. But it's going to be a little bit of a dark hole here this later summer, fall.
So when the next open season begins for the Denali project, the ConocoPhillips and BP one, assuming BP is still in the ball game because, you know, things are a little difficult for them at the moment.
They're a little preoccupied.
But assuming that this, you know, the people that are tasked mm-hmm. with this are continuing to, you know, do what they're empowered to do, what their job is, we'll have two open seasons going on at once. But basically, we won't know anything from the first one when the second one opens up, you're telling me.
Right, because the TransCanada Exxon open season closes end of July. The Denali open season tentatively is set to open up the first week of July. And you're right, you won't know what bids came in on one while the second one is underway, but that's okay, and that's probably the way it should be. It's very competitive. Certainly.
So the bidders, they know what they...
Well, the bidder will know, but bidders won't know what other bidders put
right,
in.
Right, yeah.
And the UP project, TransCanada, won't know what the Denali project might be receiving in bids, and that's probably the way it should be.
Well, you know, I looked in the FERC files. I kind of browse around in there, been all these documents and so forth. It's actually kind of interesting in a journalistic sort of way. And they have these data rooms. And I thought, well, maybe I can just drop in on a data room and see what it's like. And they got computers in there, or I guess they do and whatnot. And so I go look it up. First off, I can't find out where it is. I know there's three of them. There's one in Houston, there's one in Calgary, and there's one here in Anchorage somewhere. Somewhere there is a data room.
And it's two doors down the hall, Steve. You just missed it.
I thought that was a ladies' room.
No, it's right behind the water cooler with the secret button on the wall.
And it says, well, it's all secret, basically. You make an appointment. and you go in there. You got to give them 7 days' notice, and then you can, I guess, access all this data. I was thinking I could just, you know, stop in on my lunch hour.
Well, I think there's a lot of proprietary data in there, but as you say, there's also a lot of data available on the FERC website with the applications, more than any of us as lay people would ever want.
Indeed. Yes, it's definitely in the area of utilities regulation. Well, our guest is Larry Pursley. He is the federal coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, normally based in Washington, D.C. He is going to do a briefing for the press later today, and I asked him if he could break loose from that, come in here ahead of time, and kind of share it with the people of Alaska who are listening to Talk of Alaska. So if you got something to talk over with Larry, the number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@APRN.org. Larry, do you think there's any dispute at all that... at the current price of natural gas, you simply could not finance a natural gas pipeline at this
price,
scale.
Right. Current price is around $4 per 1,000 cubic feet. No. If you knew somehow, you know, some magical powers that gas was never going to exceed today's price at lower 48 spot markets of $4, you wouldn't build this project. That won't be enough to cover the cost of producing the gas, getting it out of the ground, putting it in a pipe, and delivering it to Chicago, Milwaukee, Spokane, Des Moines, wherever it's going to go. So it's not so much the pipeline company, but the producers who are going to be the shippers, they've got to look into their crystal balls, I guess, if you want to put it that way, and feel confident that 10 years, 12 years out from now, the price of gas will be sufficient to cover the cost of moving it. It's going to have to increase a lot from today's price.
Well, you and I have been watching this situation for years. I mean, I can remember.
Decades.
Yes, indeed. Several decades, in fact. I can remember being at the same meeting of Harold Heinz's office with you as they kind of ran through that. This was a body set up through state law, through a voter initiative, to try and promote an in-state gas pipeline. You took a rather jaundiced view of it, as I recall, at the time, saying basically, well, I just don't see, you show me how this can pencil out. This just doesn't compare because it costs so much money by the time you've got the gas transported and then liquefied that it's clearly not competitive. You still see it that way?
Well, there are a lot of people in Alaska who feel who believe instead of trying to send Alaska gas through a pipe through Alaska, Canada, into the U.S., that the better project, the more likely project, is to ship Alaska North Slope gas by pipe to Valdez, liquefy it, put it in tankers, and send it to Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, India, China. There are a lot of problems with that project, and I still believe that. There's a lot of gas across the Pacific Rim, a lot of gas trying to get into that market from Australia, Papua New Guinea, Malaysia, Indonesia, Russia, Qatar in the Middle East. There's a lot of gas, more than we have, and none of those projects need an 800-mile pipeline across the Arctic. They're right at tidewater or nearby. They can liquefy it, put it in tankers, deliver it cheaper than we can in Alaska, and it's a very price-competitive market. So, you know, I guess I don't want to sit here and say never, though I begin to think the Cubs will never make it to the World Series. But trying to fit Alaska gas into the Asian LNG market is extremely difficult and I think probably unlikely on a large scale. I'm not talking about sending a little bit, but a project that is exclusively export, 100% export, delivering all that gas into the Asian market nowhere else, I think is unlikely.
It seems that, you know, you talk about, well, you know, what is the price? I mean, Tony Palmer, as I recall, is talking about maybe you need like a $9 price or so. I think that's probably just purely a guess. But still, he's a player here.
Well, he is. He's with TransCanada. But again, they run the pipeline. It's a regulated pipeline with a guaranteed rate of return set by FERC. They're not taking the commodity risk of how much the gas is worth at the other end. I don't know if you have to have $9. You know, the problem is certainly the higher the price, the more profitable the project is for a producer. The higher the price of gas, the more difficult it's going to be to get the country to burn more of it. You're selling a commodity. You want to sell it as cheap as you can so people buy as much of it to create demand, but not so cheap that you can't make a profit.
Larry, you're giving me a headache. Larry Pursley, the Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. You have to sort of read the tea leaves on this. And it would seem that there are so many imponderables that it really does become just reading the tea leaves.
Well, it does, and taking a risk.
Yeah.
It does. And that's why, good or bad, you know, oil and gas companies go out there and look for a higher rate of return because not all their projects come in. It's a risky business. A lot of them fail. So on the ones that succeed, they want to make a good profit. I'm not apologizing for them. I'm just saying that's the reality.
Well, it would appear that given the what's happening with some of the other forms of fossil energy, that we had a catastrophic coal mine accident, we got some environmental nervousness with regards to coal now. We have tar sands that the carbon tax people are just want to stop in the worst possible way. We have offshore that probably will be crimped a bit because of this Gulf of Mexico thing. We don't know how much, but we do know the frontier is deep water, except for the shallow waters of the Arctic. and that frontier is probably very much at risk all over the world. It would seem like there are a lot of things that might favor the gas market right now.
There are. You're right. I mean, you look at the options out there. A lot of people are not very happy with a future tied to coal. You can try cleaning it, but coal is still a lot dirtier than natural gas. You know, you spill gas, and unless you light it on fire, there's not a whole lot of damage. You spill oil, and as we're finding, it's particularly offshore, so that the public's looking at that. And I think it could work out very well for the Alaska Gas Project if the country turns away from coal toward natural gas, not just for power generation, but maybe truck fleets, vehicle fleets, transportation. If people get nervous about coal, you know, good or bad, people are certainly for the next several years going to be nervous about offshore oil. So depending what Congress does with CO2, greenhouse gas emission legislation, carbon taxes, that favors natural gas over coal. So there are a lot of factors at play that could help improve the chances for an Alaska gas line.
Yeah, and it's, Alaska is in a weird position politically with all this. Traditionally, we want to sell our fossil resources. We're in favor of developing those fossil resources. We got tons and tons and tons of coal, and we have this gas. If the pipeline was there, it would probably be an economic mainstay. Maybe not quite so much as oil has been, but still a very significant one. You can see it's a difficult policy predicament. Almost in a way, you kind of wonder if maybe it would be good if our congressional delegation supported a carbon tax, because that would favor gas.
Right. It is. It's tough politics for Alaska, because a carbon tax that hits coal plants harder than natural gas-fired power plants would be good for the gas industry, good for gas demand, good for the Alaska pipeline project. But yet the politics in Alaska is generally Alaskans don't like federal EPA carbon tax emission controls that some say would hurt the oil and gas industry. So it puts Alaska in an awkward position. We can't politically really go out there and pound the table in favor of something that would help us, because it hurts other parts of our business.
Let's go to Tom, joins the program from Anchorage. Tom, you are on Talk of Alaska with Larry Pursley.
Well, thank you very much. Hi there, Larry. Hope you're having a good day. My question's kind of short and not necessarily sweet, and that is, what happens to any of the gas pipeline projects if global warming melts most of the Arctic ice cap and Prudhoe Bay effectively becomes an international port of call where they can load the tankers right there? Is that being factored into any of these decisions?
I'm not aware of anyone who's seriously looking at building a liquefaction plant at Prudhoe Bay and liquefying the gas, loading it aboard LNG tankers. Certainly, the effect of global warming, the melting of the ice cap, is very long-term, very hypothetical at this point, and I'm not aware of anyone who's prepared to spend billions of dollars to commit to that. The water's very shallow. I think there'd be a lot of environmental problems bringing in LNG tankers, and knowing you could bring them in and day out, year-round, for decades to come after you've built that plant. So I'm not aware of anyone who's looking at that as an option.
Good answer. One other quick notion, and that is sleeving the existing oil pipeline, putting a smaller pipeline in it that would carry, for instance, crude oil, and then the bulk of the pipeline being used to carry gas, because the diminishing returns of crude oil, currently anyway, indicate that the pipeline may be too big for what's being produced on the North Slope. And I'll take the rest of my answer off the air.
Well, certainly, as we know, the TAPS, the Alaska Oil Pipeline, is running two-thirds empty at the moment. But the problem is oil has to be heated to move down that line. Gas is cooled to move down the line. So I don't think you can put the two, a pipe within a pipe, and move hot oil surrounded by cold gas.
Thermodynamically, there might be a problem.
Right. And I failed engineering, but I don't think it'll work.
That length, 800 miles of that, I think there might be. Amory Levins once said, if it gets too cool, it'll turn into the world's longest chapstick. Well, I'm thinking about the Mackenzie Delta and the Canadian pipeline proposal, which is moving a little more than it had been. And this, I think, would be about a 30-incher. And I'm thinking if it were a 30-incher, it kind of takes away the potential that had been talked about of offshore facilities, kind of in line with what Tom was talking about, and a pipeline that's offshore that just goes to Mackenzie and then down Mackenzie into Canada. It'd be shorter, you know.
Well, right. The Mackenzie Delta up north in Canada has a lot of natural gas, several trillion cubic feet, and there's been a proposal out there for decades to build a pipeline that would sort of parallel the Mackenzie River Valley into northern Alberta. Their project, last estimate I saw, was about $16 billion. It's less than half the volume of the Alaska project, but they're having a lot of financial and regulatory problems. And, you know, it's sort of, for a while there, it looked like Mackenzie was ahead of us. Now it looks like we're ahead of Mackenzie.
Yeah. Do you think, speaking of the massive amount of money that's involved, if Congress doesn't come around to raising the loan guarantees for the gas line, do you think that kills any prospect of this project?
No, and I think eventually Congress will approve the higher loan guarantee. The 2004 law that set up the loan guarantee program, which also set up the Office of Federal Coordinator, set the loan guarantee amount at a maximum of $18 billion plus an inflation index, so it's around $21 billion now. But that was based on 2004 cost estimates. Now we're looking at $30 billion plus for construction, so the Alaska Congressional Delegation has been working to get that loan guarantee raised to $30 billion plus an inflation index. If the federal government guarantees the loans, you can borrow money at a lower rate because the lenders know that there's a backstop. A lower rate on the loan translates into lower costs, lower tariff for the pipeline. If Congress doesn't do it this year, maybe next year. I just don't see that as a problem.
Yeah. You know, I guess part of the problem is if it's over a period of years, maybe, the $30 billion or whatever it will, $40 billion, $40, $38 billion, however it will be, how much it may be, maybe it's not so much money over a number of years, but it all has to be spent pretty quick, and you have to get all that pipe and all that labor and get it all put together in a very short period of time. That money all has to be there.
Right. You've got to, just like building a house, you've got to borrow the money, lay out that $200,000-$400,000, build your house, you pay it back over a 30-year mortgage. That's the same thing with a pipeline. You've got to find investors willing to give you all that money relatively quickly. Construction's a few years, but you're going to have to order steel a couple years in advance, compressors a couple years in advance, pay back 25 years or so to pay back essentially the mortgage on that stuff. But you're right, the construction logistics are just amazing. Where are you going to deliver all that pipe? Are you going to bring it some to Valdez? Are you going to take it to Seward? Are you going to bring some of it to Haynes and then take it up the highway? Are you going to just bring someone through Canada, moving all that material, setting up the work camps? People who were here during the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline remember it's a tremendous logistical undertaking, and that was only 800 miles. This thing's going to be 1,800 miles, though certainly as you get into the flatter lands of Alberta, it's a little easier. The other big difference is the oil pipeline, as anyone who's seen it or seen the pictures, it's elevated. Gas line is going to be buried, so it's, I don't mean to minimize, it's digging a big trench, dumping the pipe in, covering up, and replanting it, and hopefully you'll not know it's there.
Wow, how many excavators would it take?
Some very, very large excavators, and because the pipe is so heavy, my understanding is they don't even make a side boom layer that can set the pipe into the trench without toppling over, so they're going to have to build those. But you're right, someone's going to have to figure out how many trenchers and side boom layers and welders it's going to take.
Yeah. You know, I was at the meeting of the American Society of Civil Engineers years ago in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, when they gave the Wonder of the World, Civil Engineering Wonder of the World Award to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline after it had just been built. And it is. It is. I don't think this is quite to that scale. It's not quite to the wonder of that. I mean, it's the biggest. It'll be the biggest, but I don't think it'll quite be the engineering accomplishment that TAPS
was. No, well, like you said at the beginning, people have been building pipelines for gas pipelines for a long time. They've learned a lot from TAPS that they will use it in this construction, but it'll be the longest, the biggest pipe. The gas treatment plant on the North Slope that will have to be built will be the largest in the world. We're continuing the Alaska tradition of superlatives. When we like being the biggest, the longest, the largest, unfortunately, we're always seems to be the most expensive for everything, too.
Larry Purser is our guest. He is the federal coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. And he is back in Alaska, normally in Washington, D.C. He'll be doing a press briefing. And, of course, things are picking up on the gas line front. Now is the time when the gas shippers have to kind of start thinking about what they really are going to do. And it's interesting to watch the way that this is. Our telephone number, by the way, is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk at APRN.org. I haven't checked the email. But, you know, I was thinking there's so much speculation and vaporware involved in this. And then I realized, well, it's all vaporware, really. You know, it's all, I mean, it's all just guesswork. Every bit of it. I mean,
well, educated,
you have these engineers.
Work,
I mean,
yes.
You take. I read the documents, the FERC documents, and they're so impressive with the amount of engineering work and so forth. There's already been hundreds of millions of dollars have been going into planning for this thing.
Well, even in the past 10 years, if people may remember, in 2001, the three producers, major producers on North Slope, Exxon, BP, Conoco, spent about $125 million. To pencil this thing out, see if it could work, you know, pulling it off the shelf after it had been there for years. That was $125 million then. Now TransCanada, the TransCanada Exxon team, the Denali BP Conoco team, you add those up in the past 10 years, the companies between them have spent more than $400 million trying to, as you say, do the complex engineering, the logistics, the permitting, to see if maybe we're at the time where this thing actually is an acceptable business risk and should be built. And hopefully we'll have an indication of what that answer might be by early next year.
Here's one from Ken by email. If LNG to the Asian markets is so fraught with difficulties, why did Sinopec try to jump on the AGEA train? Didn't we shoot ourselves in the foot with our xenophobic dismissal of their AGEA bid?
Well, I was not in on that bid review. That was a bid under the Alaska Gas Line Inducement
Act. We'd have to ask Pat Galvin
about
that.
Right, and that bid was judged non-responsive.
Yeah.
And I trust the state if they... So I'm not sure where the Chinese bid came up short, but the state termed it was non-responsive.
There is avid interest in Asia in Alaska gas. I've seen it.
Right, there's interest, but is there enough interest to justify this project?
Let's go to Martha, joins the program from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Martha.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Larry. I was wondering if an 800-mile pipeline is economically unfeasible, why can't we just pump the gas to ourselves and become energy independent in Alaska, which in my mind would just be a boost to everything we tried to do?
Well, because it's the same 800 miles from North Slope to Anchorage. And instead of putting a lot of gas in that line, you'd have an 800-mile line with not as costly because you'd make it smaller, but you'd still have a multi-billion dollar line and gas treatment plant with a very small customer base. So you'd have a problem trying to pay for that using not very much gas at all. So realistically, the best hope for Alaska is if this can get built, if there's a big line that sends gas out of state, and then you can have essentially spigots, valves along the way, takeoff points for Fairbanks, for the interior to take off gas, get out propane and ship it around Alaska, a takeoff point for South Central, where Alaska can benefit from the fact that everyone else is paying most of the mortgage and we get some of the benefits. You know, that really would work out best if we can make it work.
Martha? Yeah, Martha, I think it's almost a separate program to start talking about Bullet Line and the LNG plant and the geology of Cook Inlet, because they all sort of have to go together into the equation. And I think we will do that show at some point in the future. I am Steve Heimel. This is Talk of Alaska. Our guest is Larry Pursley, the Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. The calls are coming in. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. Email talk@APRN.org as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Well, we've all heard the phrase, I'm from the federal government and I'm here to help you. Our guest today he's with the federal government and he is here to make sure that the federal government actually really does help us when it comes to a natural gas pipeline. It's Larry Pursley. He's the federal coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. And Larry, what does your day consist of? Do you field phone calls? Do you have to lobby?
Well, like you said, Steve, I'm a federal official, so I spend most of my days trying to think how I can mess around with state and local governments and and intrude on people's lives. Most of the day is spent meeting with federal officials, federal permitting agencies, the Canadian officials, Canadian permitting agencies, the staff at the Federal Gas Line Office, to make sure that we're doing everything we can. When I was sworn in a couple months ago, my point was that we can't make the project more economical. We can't change the demand for gas or the markets, but we need to look at what we can do in the next 12 months that possibly maybe could help the project. Let's look at trying to find some specifics, whether it's trying to coordinate federal agencies so they're working all off the same mapping structure, so they all know what they're going to need from the applicants and give them as much advance notice as possible. So it's trying to learn as much about the agencies, the different permits, the issues, the problems, and seeing where we can head off a problem, where we can help something, where we can get two people talking who maybe weren't talking before.
If it hadn't been for your office, do you think FERC would have shown up here in such force and with such a great show of cooperation?
I think so. FERC takes this seriously.
This is a big deal for them.
Yeah. I can tell you, it's been amazing as I've met with Canadian U.S. officials, how many people work, whether it's for FERC or for Natural Resources Canada, who not just are familiar with the gas line project, but were actually on the job more than 30 years ago when the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation System and the Canada-U.S. Treaty. And there's a lot of people who would like to see this get done before they retire. They've been working at it a long time.
Yeah, and there's even a few Arctic gas people around still.
There are.
This one from Tom, I think from Fairbanks. He goes back to the over to the top, but just says, do the producers still prefer that? I don't think they admit
no.
If they do.
No, over the top refers to building a pipeline that would go from Prudhoe Bay over the top, if you will.
Or over to Mackenzie, yeah.
Over to Mackenzie, 300 miles or something, pick up Mackenzie gas and run down. That is against federal law, an over-the-top project. There's a federal law against it. There's a state law against it. Nobody talks about it. Nobody.
Okay. And the other, okay, here's one that's pretty outrageous too. Does it make sense at some point to Alyeska and the producers to wait until there isn't enough oil to run taps and then just stop running oil down the pipeline and send gas down instead?
No, you could not run gas down the taps line. It's the pipe is not thick enough, it's not strong enough, gas is pressurized. You're talking about 2,500 pounds per square inch. Taps could not hold that. That line could not be converted to a high-pressure, high-volume gas pipeline.
Mm. Larry Pursley, our guest, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. The email is talk@aprn.org. So do you have point people in, like, John Katz's office and the delegation's offices are kind of your liaisons?
Well, each of the delegation office, Congressman Young, Senator Murkowski, Senator Begich, they have staff assigned to energy issues to the pipeline. So does John Katz, the governor's representative in Washington, D.C., and my staff talks to them regularly. I talk to them regularly, try to sit down with them. You know, coordinating information is good. You know, and I also, getting back to my role or the office's role, I also think it's important to try to establish ourselves or the Office of Federal Coordinator as the source of unbiased information regarding the project, gas markets, what's going on in the LNG world, so that Alaskans will know or have an option of where to go to for information to understand what's going on in natural gas world that could affect that project. So I'd like to elevate us as a source of information.
Well, it's interesting what's happening to the markets. I'm thinking of power generation, and if power generation by coal all throughout the East Coast, if there was just something to impede that alone could have an enormous impact on the market for gas. And we're just now starting to get some LNG input capacity.
We are. The natural gas industry looks at coal. In fact, I just read a report by the Interstate Natural Gas Association of America, and they went out there and looked at coal-fired power plants around the country. And they looked specifically at the ones that did not have emission scrubbers on them, were not scheduled for installation of emission scrubbers, were at least 30, 40 years old, inefficient, probably not likely the owners were not likely to invest in emission controls on those very old inefficient plants. If just half of those older inefficient plants were converted to natural gas, or the capacity was converted from coal to natural gas, you're looking at the equivalent of an extra almost 6 billion cubic feet a day of demand nationwide for gas to replace those older plants. So the gas industry looks at those older coal-fired power plants, the dirtier ones, as a prime candidate for retirement to be replaced by gas capacity. But, you know, just as Alaskans want the gas line for the jobs and the revenue, West Virginia and Kentucky and Wyoming, the coal states, want their jobs and their public revenues too. The coal lobby is very strong, and the railroads that move all that coal across the country. So there's a political struggle in Congress as you look at greenhouse gas emissions and such between the coal lobby, gas lobby, industry. Everyone's there trying to make sure that they don't pay what they feel is an unfair portion of the price tag.
Amazing. That actually sounded unbiased.
I'm working on it. All those years when I was biased, and now maybe I can pull off the unbiased approach.
Yeah, because it is, you're right. There are all those political forces at play.
Right. And if gas's victory comes at the expense of coal, you're going to find it real hard to get coal senators voting in your favor.
Okay, well, here's another one, even a stranger slider. And that is all the shale gas and all the fuss. I mean, it's a full-time job just staying up to date on that.
I can't
stay up to date on it. Of course, it's totally not happening in Alaska, but it's going to be important for the natural gas market.
Right. The industry in the last few years has figured out how to break open deep shale formations and get all that gas out. Last I looked, shale gas was supplying more than 10% of U.S. domestic production. Tremendous growth potential. Shale gas is all over. The Marcellus Shale runs from upstate New York down into past Virginia. There's Barnett Shale in Texas. There's Haynesville in Arkansas, Louisiana. There's a lot of shale, and that is oversupplying the market, driving down the price. So if you look at, if you're a doom and gloom guy, you look at shale and say, oh, that's it, we're dead, we can never compete. But, and I think it could help us, because if all that shale gas makes utilities and other large customers feel confident that the days of natural gas price spikes are over, they don't have to worry about $10, $12, $14 price spikes for natural gas that shale will keep a price cap on, maybe they will convert more to gas-fired power plants because they'll feel comfortable. And then if we can be competitively priced with Alaska Gas, maybe in 10 or 12 years we could actually deliver gas and get a piece in the market. But Alaska Gas is going to have to sell at the same price as everyone else. We're not going to, you can't charge more for Alaska Gas because it's Alaska. It's not like salmon. It all burns the same.
Well, I was thinking in a way it's almost like salmon from what you were saying, because I remember when the price of salmon was depressed because of a farm fish. And there were some that said, wait a minute. First off, we can distinguish Alaska wild salmon market-wise. They succeeded in that. And second, this ain't all that bad for us. Right now, not that many people are eating salmon. And if this gets more people eating salmon, the pie's going to get bigger,
right,
and we could get a bigger piece.
Same thing with so if shale gas makes people feel, I can convert my fleet of 1,000 interstate trucks and I can retire that coal plant, turn to natural gas, then any increase in gas demand could be good for us. But our gas, because of that high transportation cost, we're going to have to be competitive on price. And the producers, the pipeline developer, the state, when it comes to taxes, are going to have to be realistic as to how much you can make off of this and still be competitive in the marketplace.
Oh, boy, that leads. You're not going to be able to answer this. This is purely in speculation, and it's not really in your department. But the question from Aaron and Kodiak is, how much of the revenues we get from oil could be replaced by revenues from a gas line?
I guess three answers. Not enough, not as much as we think, but a hypothetical. Let's say if after you pay the transportation costs and the deductions, let's say that gas is worth $2 per 1,000 cubic feet. And I know to a lot of people, they say, well, what does that mean? Well, let's say if it costs $4 or $4.50 to get it out of the ground and move it to market, and it sells for $6 or $6.50, which is a 50% increase from today. If the taxable value of that gas is about $2, the state would make roughly from royalty taxes about $1.5 billion a year would be the state's share of it from a 4.5 billion cubic foot a day line. If it's a $2 net value for the gas, which would be pretty good right now, we'd make about $1.5 billion royalty, production tax, corporate income tax, property tax. You know, $1.5 billion. If you look out 10 years for the first gas, that $1.5 billion would approximately replace the revenue from the oil decline that's expected the next 10 years, but it's not going to get us a net gain. It would just replace what we expect to lose in oil in the next 10 years. So it's substantial, but it is not going to make us wealthy like TAPS did overnight.
It's not the same kind of economic mainstay.
No, gas is just not as valuable.
Yeah. Here's a question from Christy, who says, and you know, all of us are actually becoming experts in oil production technology all of a sudden.
That's good.
Because the Gulf spill, all of a sudden, I didn't know what a blowout preventer was, and I certainly didn't know that they were stacking them up. But so there were 9 of them stacked one on top of the other.
I thought a blowout preventer was the cutoff switch you use at the council, so if someone's making a long speech, you cut them off?
Yeah. And we're learning all sorts of things about geology. And Christy says, hey, maybe there will be a federal regulation that requires the gas to be produced along with the oil.
Well, it might be, I guess, off federal lands. But right now, you know, the gas at Prudhoe Bay is produced, and well, it's brought to the surface. It's re-injected back underground to repressurize that field to get more oil out. So it's serving a valuable purpose right now.
Yeah, and here's one from Nick Lyons. This is the old, I think they call it the white gas issue, which was the idea of doing some refinement of natural gas to get the liquids and then shipping them down the oil pipeline.
Right, it's called GTL or gas to liquids. It's a process that South Africa used when they couldn't buy oil from people. The problem with gas to liquids is you lose close to 40% or you consume close to 40% of the gas in the conversion process. So you're taking gas on an earth slope. You'd have to build a very expensive plant to convert it. You're going to burn up 40% of that gas converting it, so the economics get tough.
Larry Pursley is our guest, and we're all over the place about gas. He is the federal coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, and he's ready to talk to you as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
When you try to look at the issue of building a natural gas pipeline, the first thing that you learn is that almost all the information has got a spin on it one way or another. Some interest is pushing something, and it is very hard to kind of get through that informational briar patch with any kind of really solid information. The person that is sitting across from me on Talk of Alaska today has the job of trying to keep all that information straight and help along the process of getting a natural gas pipeline built from Alaska. He's Larry Pursley. His job was earlier filled with by Drew Pierce, but it was the same deal. It was trying to get the process moving. Well, the process is moving now, but it's at the point where the big question marks show up. And that's what we're talking about now. There are lots of question marks surrounding those question marks even. So it's a fascinating thing to do talk radio about because there's very little factual basis no matter. We can say whatever we want. Let's go to David in Denali Park. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Larry Pursley.
Good morning. Larry, I have a question. I've never really quite understood why we don't seriously, or can you help me understand the economics of why an LNG line to an Alaska port wouldn't be a way to go with the Japanese, South Korean, Taiwanese, and Chinese markets so huge and the availability to ship it to the West Coast? Why is that not considered economically feasible?
Well, I don't know if it's not. I guess I don't want to make a pronouncement. It's never going to be economically feasible, but you talk about those markets being huge. Actually, it's the reverse. The North American market on an average day burns five times as much gas as the Taiwanese, South Korean, Japanese, China, and India market combined. It's a much bigger market here. When you've got a lot of gas, you're better off, I think, trying to put that gas into the world's largest market rather than a market that is one-fifth the size. Now, in terms of moving Alaska gas to the West Coast, because of federal law, you'd something called the Jones Act. You would have to use tankers that are built in the United States to move a commodity from U.S. to U.S. No U.S. shipyard has built a LNG tanker in almost 40 years. So price competitiveness, if you, it would just become a very expensive proposition to move gas from Alaska to the West Coast. The West Coast is a small market compared to the entire North American market. And if you land that gas in California or Oregon, the pipes don't exist to move it into the Midwest. It's just moving it into Alberta and then into a North American market is the biggest market in the world. And that's apparently, well,
wasn't that game finally over when they finally got an LNG plant down in Baja?
Well, there is an LNG plant in Baja that then takes the gas from Indonesia and Russia and delivers it into California. It's a small market right now on the West Coast, small compared to all of North America, and it's adequately supplied. They don't need our gas.
David?
Yeah, so I guess my follow-up question is, the burgeoning Chinese economy is purchasing energy from every source they can find. If we build it, they will come, they will buy it, they will build their infrastructure, I would think. But I'm sure that the big oil companies, they just don't see that on paper yet, so they're probably not prepared to spend the money to do it.
But China also has shale gas possibilities. China has some domestic gas. China can have a pipeline. LNG is not the only option. China will buy gas down to the penny from the cheapest supplier they can. And Australia and Papua New Guinea will probably always be able to deliver gas to them cheaper than Alaska. So it's not impossible. It's just some very intense price competition there.
All right, David. Thanks for your call, David, from Denali Park. Let's go to Randy, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Randy.
Thanks, Steve. My question for Larry is if anybody is planning for the social impacts of building the pipeline. I know when we built TAPS, there was, with the big construction project, lots of prostitution, drug abuse, you know, an increase in the need for police services. Is your office or anybody planning for that?
No, that wouldn't be our office, but that will be covered in the environmental impact statement at the federal level. I know the state has spent years talking about that. I think people learned a lot from what happened with the oil pipeline, and as my sense is following this for years, the state and federal agencies will look at that much more seriously than they did under TAPS and are very aware of the problems.
And then how would the services be paid for, the need for more services?
Well, I'd say that's one of the issues that I know when I was with the state, they talked about maybe this one of the idea back, 6-7 years ago was maybe the state advancing money to municipalities to help them cover the expenses, and the state recovers it later from tax revenue. But ideas have been kicked around. I'm not involved in any of the conversations. I don't know if they're ongoing now, but people are aware of it.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right, Randy, thanks for your call. And Phil had a similar question. What is the actual process on EIS? At what point does the public get to say, you really need to look at this or that impact?
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission will be the lead agency on the draft EIS and the final EIS. They will not start that process until one or both of the project sponsors submit an application for the EIS. Right now, I believe TransCanada Exxon is talking about submitting their application 2012. Denali is talking about submitting theirs in 2013, so we're still a little bit away from that. But as everyone knows, the EIS process is involves a lot of public comment.
Larry Pursley is our guest. Larry, I forgot to include you. You have such a long career in public service that I forgot to mention you worked for the Revenue Department for a while.
I think I've worked for everyone but public radio.
You haven't?
Feels like it sometimes.
There may be some jobs coming open once the EIS comes out. Let's go to Ken, joins the program from Talkeetna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Larry Pursley.
Thanks, Steve. Larry, you guys were just talking about the Barnett Shale or the shale gas down in the lower 48, and I happen to own mineral rights in the Barnett Shale.
Excellent.
The producer's saying that he has 40 years worth of production out of there, and I'm kind of curious on how we can economically bring Alaska's gas to market when there's those type of reserves available in the lower 48.
Well, I'm hoping we can. I guess we've got to hope that we can be price competitive. There's no question there's a lot of gas there. There's certainly some value to having different supply points so you're not getting it all from one field. I don't think the Barnett Shale field could produce 80 billion cubic feet a day to supply the entire North American market. So we've got to hope that some comes from Barnett, some comes from Marcellus, some comes from the old Canadian fields, and some comes from Alaska as people look out 10, 20, 30 years and figure where they're going to get 80 billion cubic feet a day. Then you're right, the Barnett Shale is huge. It may last for 100 years, but it can't deliver all that much on a day.
Right.
And the other limiting factor, I think, that's going to come with the shale gas that essentially hasn't been regulated too much into existence yet is the water quality issue. There's a massive amount of water that gets cycled through that, and I'm kind of doubtful. At some point, there just won't be enough water and enough clean water, and regulation will start to step in on that.
That is a problem. A shale field, an average shale well to initiate production takes anywhere from 2, 3, 4 million gallons. That's about as much as a golf course uses in a month. So you've got to find that water and then do something with it as it gets produced and comes back up. And that could be a constraining factor in the years ahead.
Yeah, but you know, it's a...
Speaking about the water issue, there's already been problems in the Barnett where people's, you know, water well, their water sources are going dry because so much water is being used in the shale industry. So that's kind of, it's surprising that it's not already regulated, but that's, I guess that's another issue.
Well, there is, Congress is considering adding regulations to shale production.
Yeah, and we are, we haven't figured out the water economy, but it's dawning on us real quick. That's another area, by the way, where Wally Hickel was kind of a prophet. He said that water was one of our most valuable things. We just didn't realize it yet. I think it's a fact. Let's go to Anonymous from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, Mr. Pursley, I am just want to express how disappointed I am in listening to you and your obvious biases, beginning with your bias against federal employees. And I understand you're a former federal employee, but you seem to imply with your opening statement that I am a retired resource manager, federal, and your opening statement implied that federal employees were blockages, that federal agencies are blockages to getting things done, whereas, in fact, I worked with an incredible group of dedicated people, managers, interested in following the laws of Congress that Congress put forth and protecting the resources, which includes human beings, but resources as well. And to have you laugh at the fact you've never heard of a blowout preventer, to have you laugh, you seem to be laughing at BP and the whole situation in the Gulf, which I think is tragic. And frankly, you scare me. Your presence there scares me. And I would like you to take your job more seriously. And I had to turn off my radio in order to make this phone call. So when I turned it back on, I heard the moderator say something about how unbiased you were. And that is not what I'm hearing. And I think that it would be behoove you to return to a sense of you. We have good federal employees doing the best job they can in the face of pushes from people like you and Congress trying to override the natural environment.
Well, you know,
yeah, thank you for your for that call. I think we did get a little facetious about federal employees there, and the fact of the matter is a lot of hard work from federal employees.
And I don't think federal employees are an impediment to the progress or staying away the project. The law that was passed in 2004 directs the office to coordinate and make sure no one does anything that gets in the way, that's unreasonably gets in the way, but that's just the law. Yeah. I think federal employees are great, and state employees too.
Yeah, and I think it's maybe a couple of media people here who are, are always having to get the same kind of syndrome like police do, where you deal in black humor because it's in your face so much. Larry, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Next week on Talk of Alaska, our guest will be Senator Mark Begich, Dave Waldron on the controls, Josh Edge and BD Trantina on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.